Hello, this is Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Caught: How Steven Peters Got Entangled in a Ponzi Scheme That Resulted in a 40-Year Prison Sentence. The story begins with a second headline inside the Triangle Business Journal, The Bust of a Ponzi Scheme, by Lauren Onasorge. Steven Condon Peters, the man who touted himself as your most trusted advisor to dozens of clients, had his audience. Dressed in a suit, he looked more salesman than a suspect, despite the looming presence of Judge James Deaver. It was June 5, at the tail end of his two-week-long trial for wire fraud charges, and he stood in front of the jury, marker in hand. On an oversized notebook, he gave a testimony that seemed more pitch than defense. What a salesman he was, prosecutor William Gilmore would tell the jury in closing arguments. And the comment appeared to ring true as Peters tried to walk the jury through the value proposition he sold to clients at Vision Quest in Raleigh. Individuals, when they first come to us, they normally have a problem, Peters said, noting that the first step is the discovery process. Visions, values, and goals, he said. Where will you be in 12 months? By helping to visualize what clients want, he could help them get there, he told the jury. But those clients never realized that in a matter of years, much of the fortunes they'd entrusted to Peters would be gone. They didn't realize that for some, their retirement plans would be ruined within 12 months, or that 46-year-old Peters, as Gilmore would say in his opening argument, had his own set of goals, goals about money, goals about possessions. And that they'd be crowded into a chilly courtroom years later, watching their most trusted advisor led away in handcuffs, facing 40 years in a federal prison for what prosecutors claim to be a $15 million Ponzi scheme that affected scores of individuals across multiple states. Peters currently is in a medium security federal correction institution in Petersburg, Virginia. Through interviews, court testimony from 64 witnesses, and public documents, a picture emerges of what happened in that case, despite the sentence, is still not over. A promising childhood. Peters was born September 19, 1973, a day his father, Stephen Peters Sr., also an investor, remembers as an epic event. The nurse took him over and cleaned him up on the table, and he actually raised up, using his two hands, and turned his head toward me and looked at me, and the nurse hollered at the doctor and said, "Look at this, I've never seen a baby do that." Peters Sr. recalls. His father has many stories like that, such as the time that Steve, at 3 1/2, taught himself to ride a two-wheeler, or how at 12 years old he started Stevie's Lawn Service, Peters Sr. says. "I began to think that this kid is going to be an entrepreneur," his father recalls. The family lived in Pennsylvania, and Peters made the varsity football team at Parkland High School as a freshman. He was the kid, family members recall, who would get up at 5 a.m. and work out, an all-star player by his senior year, by relatives' account. It was important, even then, to be liked. He landed at Muhlenberg College, where he majored in communications and minored in business. MIT, which, according to court testimony, he bragged about attending to clients, doesn't have any record of him as a student. Peter's LinkedIn page describes an MIT certificate in supply chain management, something MIT says it could neither confirm or dispute. His father recalls what Peters really wanted to do was become an FBI agent. He became a Marine to get experience in the real world, perhaps bettering his bid for the Bureau, Peters Sr. says. After school, he served at Camp Lejeune, though not, as the prosecutors allege he told clients, a member of Special Operations. He left service as a captain, according to court testimony. He married Amy Peters, his wife of 21 years, who would attend every day of his trial in summer 2019. Peters nearly had his dream of being an FBI agent, according to his father, but for scheduling. "They don't recruit because of the federal fiscal year. They don't hire until October," Peter Sr. recalled, so he needed to do something. And through a recruiting company that specialized in placing veterans in the private sector, multiple sources say, he found SEI Investments and his future in finance. While there, he testified to the court that he helped run a startup division, a segment focused on high net worth individuals. Rising in the investment world. But the entrepreneurial itch, or ego, depending on whom you ask, took hold, leading him to start putting together a plan in 2003 for what would become Vision Quest. In October 2005, with Amy 8 months pregnant, so it was a fun time to start a brand new business, he testified. He brought Vision Quest to Raleigh, a couple of hours from where he'd served as a Marine. As described by Triangle Business Journal at the time, a group of Philadelphia wealth management experts has moved to the Triangle to start a new company called Vision Quest Wealth Management. As TBJ reported, most of the firm's then 7 employees were working for SEI Investments before Peters branched out, setting up his initial operation at the 430 Davis Drive office building at Keystone Park. As of 2005, it had just 15 clients managing about $50 million in assets. Within 2 years, Peters would say the client count had swelled to 83. In 2007, the firm moved to downtown Raleigh and an office suite at the Palladium Plaza building on Blunt Street, choosing to buy. Peters said at the time, in light of Vision Quest Wealth Management's expansion possibilities and the current downtown vitalization in Raleigh. The firm would later settle into an office on Harget Street, the same headquarters the FBI would raid in 2017. In 2008, Peters founded Vision Quest Capital, operating both as hybrid firms on Blunt Street. Prosecutors described it as a way to get even more money from clients. Instead of just managing their assets, he could get them to invest in his entities. Initially, the operation was quiet. "We have existed under the radar," Peters said then. In 2011, however, Peters' Vision Quest Capital made a big splash via Facebook. According to TBJ reports, Peters secured Facebook shares for 30 investors in North Carolina and Georgia. The group invested nearly $1 million to capture a stake in the initial public offering. To do it, Peters and Vision Quest apparently set up a limited liability entity, VQFB LLC, with 30 investors paying a combined $970,000 for an undisclosed stake. And Peters said it was a success. In 2012, Vision Quest raised $10 million in a fund that, according to a securities filing, committed investors to funneling at least $500,000 each into a limited liability company called Southeast Industrial Acquisition. At the time, its Vision Quest Wealth Management arm had $21 million under management. Expanding investments. In 2013, the Opportunity Investment Arm acquired James Taylor Auto Park, LLC, and a related finance company, Angel Acceptance. The firms were consolidated into a holding company called Angel Automotive Group, and Peters started, prosecutors say, soliciting wealth management clients for his other ventures. At the same time, he was growing his wealth management empire, creating what prosecutors would later describe as a front for the greater scheme. In 2015, for example, Vision Quest would grow its wealth management arm by purchasing financial firms such as Tippett Group and Deckert Financial Management, which had combined assets of about $120 million. The plan was to soon be at $1 billion in assets under management, Peters said in 2016. Along the way, Peters became consumed by their Christian beliefs, friends and family would later say, something clients would later testify became common ground, another reason to trust Peters with their money. Peters Sr., raised Catholic, says his son's faith was unexpected. He claims Peters went to divinity classes and taught Bible studies. Faith is a gift. You either get the gift or you don't get the gift, he says. My son got it. Another way Peters reeled in investors was through upscale parties. He tried to have a personal relationship with his clients, something that some say made them uncomfortable. I've hired you to be my investment person. I don't want to have a personal relationship with you, former client Marie DiPietro said in a 2017 interview. She called him an arrogant, pompous person who flaunted his wealth, but she invested anyway. Another former client, Harry Miletus, says he also utilized relationships he'd acquired. Miletus trusted college friend Joe Baker. Peter's chief investment officer, who called his investment a home run, guaranteed, no risk at all. I didn't like him, Melita says of Peters. He talked about himself the entire time, told me he was a sniper in the Marines, which was debunked through court testimony. But he, too, signed the note. Others say they relied on Peters' inflated resume and on his misrepresentations that their retirement would be safe. It wasn't. You have to work a really long time to have $150,000, says Denise Janowski, another former client, after the payments stopped coming. We're sort of frozen. Who do we trust, and where do we go from here? Lavish lifestyle. Along the way, life seemed good for Peters, living at his farm on Raleigh's Thays Road, complete with a clubhouse to entertain clients, and traveling to luxurious vacation spots. More than 15 years ago, he and his wife bought a beach house in Emerald Isle. They followed it up through a Vision Quest connected entity with the house in Costa Rica. Peters testified that he always looked at it as an investment, but prosecutors pointed out that his family's picture was on the rental site as the owner and that his wife managed the Costa Rica entity despite investor money going toward the property. The terms of the house agreement had Vision Quest Capital owning only the royalties, the rental income. Peters, who owned the land, could continue to own the house. Vision Quest Capital put in $650,000 for the house and $200,000 for the furnishings, but according to court testimony, the ownership terms had the company entitled to those royalties only through 2026 or the sell date. Peters testified that it was the most appropriate way to hold the property and said it was meant to be sold. The jury didn't buy it and included the property among the assets up for forfeiture. Peters testified that his role evolved and others took the helm of day-to-day investment protocol. I outlined some basic concepts to my staff, he said, something disputed through their testimony. His staff claimed he ruled with a temper. They claimed the company, despite what clients testified they were told by Peters, was never profitable. Stacy Bean, a colleague and star witness of the prosecution, testified that to complete payroll, she had to contact Amy Peters for funds. During his own testimony, Peters pointed to his staff. His attorneys repeatedly said Peters trusted the wrong people, including Bean. Bean and others did admit to wrongdoing, but only Peters was charged, a fact brought up multiple times by defense attorneys Wes Camden and Caitlin Poe. Bean claimed she was scared I would lose my job and did what Peters told her to do, including fabricating documents for the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission probe. Bean, like some others on Peters' staff, was fresh out of college. In his testimony, Peters said he invested time in training employees, taking them under his wing. He claims to have taken a particular interest in Nick Kolbenschlag, a recent graduate of NC State University, soon turned compliance officer. In his own testimony, Kolbenschlag claims he thought funds at VisionQuest were safe with a risk profile closer to a bond than a stock, and he blamed his own lack of experience for his naivete. Investors would write checks through promissory note agreements, he and others testified, and the employee said Peters was part of the process, talking to clients personally, trying to reel in their investments. VisionQuest would hold a client's principal for 5 years at an 8% annual interest. Employees like Kolbenschlag would get bonuses when VisionQuest wealth management clients invested in VisionQuest Capital, seemingly unaware of the conflict of interest. And clients didn't suspect anything as long as checks were coming, and they were, at least until the FBI raid in 2017. Not all was as it seemed on Harget Street. Instead of investing in VisionQuest Capital portfolio companies, they were often funneling money into Peters' wallet, prosecutors would allege, and new investments were used to make payments to earlier investors, essentially a Ponzi scheme. None the wiser, clients continued to sign promissory notes. Kolbenschlag, like many of the clients, believed Peters had made more than 50 past successful deals. Kolbenschlag testified that he thought Peters' average rates of return were about 40%. In fact, multiple VisionQuest portfolio companies were failing and filing for bankruptcy. Kolbenschlag admitted he left on bad terms, fired right before a holiday weekend in 2016. Months later, however, Peters is alleged to have ordered backdated letters, putting the responsibility for some of his alleged misdeeds on Kolbenschlag. Beam claimed to have copied the letters onto letterhead herself at Peter's behest, copying and pasting Kolbenschlag's signatures. There were warning signs, though. New clients may not have had access to those signals as his FINRA file, even as he was being publicly investigated, didn't warn of any pending charges. Subject of lawsuits. Peters and VisionQuest were the subject of two lawsuits filed in Wake County Superior Court in 2015, cases later transferred to the North Carolina Business Court. While both suits were voluntarily dismissed with prejudice in 2016, some of the allegations they contain are similar to those made by other individuals in multiple consumer complaints filed with the North Carolina Attorney General's office. Both lawsuits mention a company that apparently failed to make money, Fusion Fund Group. A lawsuit was filed by Brian and Colleen Brenner against VisionQuest, Peters, and another VQ employee on April 23, 2015. And we're going to skip the rest of this section that details more of the lawsuits and go to the next section, Scheme Unravels. The checks kept coming, and for the bulk of the clients, nothing seemed amiss. Internally, the scheme unraveled when his own employees, including Bean, wore wiretaps. Bean testified she approached the Federal Bureau of Investigation of her own volition. "I saw that the money was gone. I didn't think it was right," she told the court. Bean would record secret conversations, many later played in court, where Peters appeared to admit pulling out more than $4 million, allegedly, for personal expenses. Peters denied responsibility. He also denied the alleged cover-up involving forged documents and deleted files. "I'm not an IT person," he said, pushing the blame to Bean, who he says was told to remove sensitive attorney-client information from files requested by regulators investigating the situation. "I knew nothing about the deleted files," he said, an argument the jury didn't buy, nor did the prosecutor. "You admitted you told your staff not to go off script," Gilmore said. "And you wrote the script, didn't you? All those employees that came in here and testified were lying. Is that your testimony?" "Yes," Peters responded. When Gilmore asked if the clients testifying against him, too, were lying, he said, "I don't know what they were doing. I think they were upset about losing money." Peters did have supporters throughout the trial, though. They include family and friend and client Kim Stonebreaker, who said she met the Peters through their children, then built a close relationship through 7 years of Bible study. "I was investing in Steve's ability. There was no guarantee," she said. But while Peters testified, he never made false assurances to investors, including specifically statements that he never told them the business was profitable. Stonebreaker testified differently. "Did he talk about being profitable?" Gilmore asked. "Yes," she replied. Peters had real believers, those nodding along in the pews when he gave his defense. "The emails prosecutors say he sent couldn't have been him," he testified, "because he was on a hunting trip. His computer was in an unlocked office, his passwords on a yellow sticky on the top left of the monitor." "Did you control the investment committee?" Attorney Ward asked on his behalf. "No," he responded. But the jury returned a guilty verdict on all counts and later a 40-year sentence. Still fighting. The case continues, both over restitution and through the appeals process. Peters, now prisoner number 64439-056, still claims he's innocent of criminal wrongdoing through attorney William Turpining. Just this month, the feds accused Peters of trying to unravel the forfeiture of his family farm. He was ordered by a jury to forfeit property, including the farm, as a way to potentially pay back dozens who say they lost millions. But Peters, according to a 24-page filing by John Harris, assistant United States attorney, is trying to exploit the process through an LLC. An entity called the South Dakota Trust Company, a trustee of a trust set up by Peters and his wife, wants to unravel the forfeiture of one of those properties, an approximately 93-acre farm abutting Lake Wheeler in Raleigh, Harris writes. In court testimony, it was alleged that Peters purchased the farm in 2012 with fraud proceeds. They allegedly convinced two of their purported victims, Eric and Sharon Harris, who testified at the sentencing and trial respectively, to form a company with them to buy it. Little did the Harrises know that Peters was using the Harrises' own money to fund his portion of the down payment on the farm, the filing reads. A year later, the Peters transferred their 65% interest in the company with the title to the farm, known as Harris Peters LLC, to South Dakota Trust Company. To hear the trustee tell it, that simple fact is dispositive in the forfeiture matter. Steve Peters transferred his interest in HP LLC. He is not the record owner. And so this court cannot forfeit the farm or the trustee's interest, Harris writes in his motion. But that is not how forfeiture law works. Criminals cannot escape forfeiture merely by transferring their ownership interest to straw owners while the criminal retains control of the property. Harris has asked the court to dismiss the claim for lack of standing. In the meantime, his former clients are still waiting on payment, and they're still angry. Steve deserves what he got, Melita says. He's a punk, and you can quote me. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. After promoting Garner for years, he's ready to retire. Neil Padgett landed in the role of Garner's key cheerleader because, frankly, he needed a job. He was working at a manpower agency in downtown Raleigh more than a decade ago when the agency was sold and Padgett found himself out of work. But the Garner native, with an ebullient personality, soon attracted the interest of members of the board at the Garner Chamber of Commerce. Sure, thought Padgett, he'd give running the chamber a try. So in 2016, Padgett became president of a Garner chamber with a budget of only around $200,000, and he felt limited scope. The chamber was kind of isolated. We were siloed into Garner, and I came in, and the first thing I thought was, okay, I'd always worked in downtown Raleigh, and even though we're not but 10 minutes away, we aren't doing anything with them. So my first pitch was an image of Garner being a part of an urban, successful area, not a neighboring town. Some of those connections paid off, such as with Curtis Media, which supported the Broadway Voices push, and Wake Med, which opened an emergency care unit in Garner in 2013. The chamber budget has passed $500,000, and membership has risen from 500 when Padgett arrived to around 650 now. Padgett, 65, plans to retire February 15 and quips that he wants to leave while he's still wanted. But he also leaves knowing he has contributed to the remarkable rise of his hometown. Now I feel like we have become more a part of a successful urban region, he says, while recognizing the strong small-town feel in Garner. But we still have a community spirit like nobody else. CEO says Drive Shack has aced expectations. Hana Khoury, CEO of Drive Shack, said on a recent earnings call that the golf entertainment company's Generation 2.0 opening in Raleigh and other markets was a huge success. They've all significantly outperformed our expectations, beating our projected revenue plan by approximately 21%, Khoury told analysts. The Raleigh location opened August 23. Smart devices might be a big help for aging population. We think of smart devices as being geared toward millennials. Hey, Alexa, call my boss and tell her I'm sick. But an executive with a Raleigh-based company is predicting that the technology could be of immense value to the elderly and those with a disability. Kuldip Pabla, Senior Vice President of Engineering at K4 Connect, says older adults like the ease of use with new technologies, and he expects proactive voice to begin to emerge as a key support system for seniors as they initiate conversations based on time of day and certain events. For instance, if a smart home, i.e. bed sensors, senses that an older adult got up from their bed, it could greet the older adult with a brief rundown of the day. If it is morning, at the same time, it could offer help if the older adult got up from bed during the middle of the night, he adds. In a similar way, voice will offer many more natural features, such as casually reminding older adults to take their medication. Tammy Lynn Center has a leadership change. One of the Triangle's best-known nonprofits has a sudden leadership change. Holly Richard, the president and CEO of the Tammy Lynn Center the past 8 years, will leave her post November 20, the organization announced November 13. The Tammy Lynn Center, which is rebranding as TLC, began in 1969 as an effort to help those with developmental and intellectual disabilities. It was recently inducted into the Raleigh Hall of Fame. Richard, in a statement, said, This is truly a unique organization made up of a dedicated and loving staff serving some of our state's most fragile yet amazing individuals. She cited personal reasons for her departure. Dan Daniel, TLC's chief development officer the past 4 years, will serve as interim CEO. Want to be an entrepreneur? Check out NC State. If you're a budding entrepreneur, then NC State University may be the place for you. The Princeton Review and Entrepreneur Magazine just released their top undergraduate programs for entrepreneurship studies for 2020, and the Wolfpack is ranked a sweet number 10 on the list. That's up from number 11 last year and number 19 the year before. NC State's graduate program also debuted on the list at number 21. Tom Miller, Senior Vice Provost for Academic Outreach and Entrepreneurship, says the recognition effectively serves as a beacon for prospective students interested in entrepreneurship that NC State is the place to go to develop an entrepreneurial mindset and pursue your passions. Chancellor Randy Woodson, since arriving in 2010, has emphasized a closer relationship with the business community. The NC State Entrepreneurship Garage has launched 31 active companies with $75 million in venture capital investments, and the Chancellor's Innovation Fund helped spark a dozen new companies. And finally, IBM adds interesting member to its board of directors. One of Research Triangle Park's largest employers may be about to dig deeper into the insurance space. That's because IBM, the parent company of Red Hat, just tapped Thomas Buberl, CEO of global insurance giant AXA SA, as its latest board member. Buberl comes with a lengthy insurance pedigree, having also had leadership roles at Switzerland of Zurich Financial Services and Boston Consulting Group. IBM CEO Ginni Rometty said, "His international perspective and experience in leading a multinational insurance company into the digital era will make him a valuable addition to the IBM board." And now we turn to the On Banking and Technology page in the Triangle Business Journal, written by Lauren Onasorge. First Horizon makes a move. Laura Bunn, Triangle Market President for First Horizon, will now oversee more branches. Laura Bunn's territory is about to get bigger. Bunn, Triangle Market President for Tennessee-based First Horizon National, says the company's decision to snap up 30 SunTrust branches just days after First Horizon announced its pending merger with IberiaBank is a big deal. The buy, in connection with required divestments for SunTrust's merger with BB&T, created a real opportunity for us, she says. In North Carolina, the SunTrust package adds 25 branches to First Horizon, including 11 in the Triangle. "We've known the bank has a strong desire to expand in the Triangle, and we've had ongoing conversations of our desire to grow this market," she says, calling the expansion here a real statement of commitment to the Triangle. According to the latest numbers from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, SunTrust is the fifth biggest bank in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties, combined with about 9% of the market share. First Horizon, previously under the First Tennessee and Capital Bank brands, holds a combined 2.8% in the three counties. "I'm certain that customers will wonder how they'll be affected, but First Horizon will communicate well in advance with customers," Bunn says. And she says the bank expects to retain all current branch employees when the purchase closes. South State eyes Raleigh market. In cutting the ribbon on its new Raleigh branch this month, this one dubbed a regional headquarters, the $15.7 billion asset South State Corporation is sending a signal to the Triangle: it's coming for your business. That's according to executives at the Columbia, South Carolina-based South State Bank. "South State Bank is growing in the Raleigh market," says Ben Collier, Raleigh market president. The new Glenwood Avenue location houses all four business lines, from commercial banking to retail to mortgages and wealth management. "A natural evolution of our expansion in Raleigh," he says. Jay Reagan, the bank's president of North Carolina, says the investments come down to opportunity, calling the area a great opportunity for growth. The bank's buy of Park Sterling gave it a local production office, and it's now up to two local branches. Up next is selling its value proposition in the highly competitive Raleigh market. Our unique size allows us to be agile and attentive in ways our competitors simply can't, Collier says. In North Carolina, people are willing to wait for fiber, CEO says. Elliot Noss, president and CEO of the Canadian firm Tuckos, says the firm's construction of Ting brand fiber in the Triangle is progressing very well, and customers are willing to wait. Of course, we've worried about whether these pent-up pre-orders would suffer in conversion from the wait for serviceability, he told analysts on a recent earnings call. Even prospects that wait as long as 1 and even 2 years for their pre-orders to become serviceable have still been converting at over 80%. The Ting footprint has been expanding in the region. Roseville was added to the mix in September. In a section called He Said It, the quote, "In Uber, we wrote a new type of risk that initially seemed very profitable, but Uber's business and the underlying risk evolved very quickly. The risk associated with this model shifted as the company expanded into new regions, added tens of thousands of drivers, and evolved beyond just ride hailing." And that's from J. Adam Abram, CEO of James River Group Holdings, explaining why the company, whose executive team is based in the Triangle, dropped its biggest client, Uber. Spiffy scores big deal with Florida acquisition. Research Triangle Park startup Spiffy has made another acquisition, one that expands both the team and the market for what co-founder Scott Wingo has dubbed fleet management as a service. The on-demand car service firm has acquired Your Location Lubrication, a Florida-based mobile oil change operation. Financial details were not disclosed. According to its Inc. 5000 profile, YLL earned $10.1 million in revenue in 2018, and that success is part of the appeal, says Wingo. He says YLL is a little bit larger than us from a revenue perspective and will enable Spiffy to really scale its services. What they have is a capability and a focus on higher volume, Wingo says. YLL has a truck capable of doing between 4 and 6 oil changes simultaneously, he explains. That gives YLL a high-volume capacity that, at least until this buy, Spiffy couldn't match, and that has given YLL opportunities outside of Spiffy's reach, such as deals with some of the larger rental car companies. We have been competing with these guys since we started to really focus in on helping fleets with preventative maintenance, including oil changes, he says. We figured if you can't beat them, then buy them. And finally, in a section called He Said It, Channel Advisor looks to build out sales team return unit to 2017 levels. Channel Advisor is building its sales team as it looks to drive growth in the coming year. The quote, "We're really just kind of getting our normal sales capacity back to the levels that we had back in 2017, so kind of just getting back to a level that's, I think, appropriate to cover the market opportunity and, importantly, offsetting that from savings in other areas." That's from David Spitz, CEO, told investors that on a recent earnings call. Overall, Spitz called its latest quarter solid, pointing to inline revenue of $31.7 million. The quote comes after a reorganization in July. He said that while a gradual decline in the number of quota-carrying headcount led to a lack of bookings in the U.S. over the last couple of years, the trend is ending under the leadership of a new North American sales head, Paul Colucci, promoted to the role in August. And now we turn to A Better World, inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene. First, we start with a column written by Jennifer Toll Whiteside, who is the CEO and president of the North Carolina Community Foundation. The headline, "'Tis the time for corporate gift giving." What would you do if a customer paid an invoice with $500 in pennies? What about 100 used pencils or a truckload of pumpkins? For nonprofits in our community, these are real situations that community leaders have had to face. I can tell you the stories. Things such as this happen from a place of good intentions, but are executed with a lack of thought and strategy that results in a tough situation and undue burden for the nonprofit receiving the unrequested gift. As we approach the holiday season and many business leaders are planning ways to give back before the end of the year, now is the time to pause and consider how corporate giving can go beyond an annual collection of canned goods to ongoing partnerships with as many benefits for the giver as the recipient. Thanks to the critical role the nonprofit sector plays in strengthening our community and economy, a strategic business partnership offers corporate leaders the opportunity to align with their customer base, enrich the lives of employees, generate positive publicity, and reach target demographics in addition to helping the local community. As you evaluate how to be an effective corporate partner for the nonprofit sector, consider the following strategies. When considering gifts of funds, evaluate providing flexible or general funding that allows nonprofits to align resources with their organizational and community priorities. Businesses understand that adaption, flexibility, and financial stability are important qualities of successful business. The same goes for nonprofits. Remember that funding helps make a nonprofit more attractive to other potential funders. Corporate partners are uniquely positioned to invest in efforts that position organizations to attract further support. Corporations can also encourage individual employee giving, volunteering, and service through a matching gifts program and comp time for nonprofit service, board or volunteering, as well as partnering with nonprofits to recruit business leaders for board of directors. Think about filling a need or area of expertise that an organization doesn't have and likely can't afford. For example, Michelle Zechman, CEO of Haven House Services, shared that when they began looking for a new building, they knew they needed lots of expertise. About a year before they got started, they pulled together a group that included a real estate attorney, vice president from a major property company, partners from an architecture firm, and a commercial real estate broker. She shared that their expertise was vital throughout the process and added incredible value to the organization and its partners. Other investments could be like gifts of leadership trainings or seminars, technology, financial education, and strategic planning support that can be difficult for nonprofits to secure, but has a tremendous impact on an organization's long-term ability to serve the community. Ultimately, if you want better social outcomes, nonprofits need room to evaluate existing efforts, room to experiment with new approaches, investment in scaling proven services, and freedom to undertake new bold efforts to move the bar. Successful corporate partnerships help nonprofits do just that while paying dividends to the business. And in the nonprofit news, the Green Chair Project expands Raleigh showroom. The Green Chair Project, a Raleigh nonprofit that provides home furnishings for people in need, has expanded and remodeled. The nonprofit had previously leased its building for 6 years from Blunt and Murray Williams before having the opportunity to purchase the building at a substantial discount. The Green Chair unveiled its expanded and remodeled facility on October 24. The Green Chair takes in donated furniture, cleans and repairs it, and allows people in need to shop for furnishings for their home for a small fee. The expansion will allow the Green Chair to double its reach and serve more than 1,000 households annually. "We are truly amazed by the number of organizations and individuals who have contributed to our cause. As we near the unveiling of our new facility, we want to thank everyone who has made all the Green Chair Project's vision a reality since 2010, said Jackie Craig, co-founder and executive director of the Green Chair Project. The Green Chair's capital campaign is currently $150,000 from its goal of $3 million. Runners for V Foundation raised nearly $350,000 in New York City Marathon. The V Foundation for Cancer Research says Team V, the foundation's endurance fundraising program, raised nearly $350,000 by participating in the TCS New York City Marathon on November 3. Team V had 76 members. Brian Yurko led fundraising with more than $10,000 as he ran his first ever marathon for friends and family that have been affected by cancer. Melissa Smith, another Team V member, was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin lymphoma in 2010. "I feel like it is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to run this race," Smith said. "So many people diagnosed with cancer may not ever get to see their dreams come true, so I do this for all my friends, family, and strangers that are burdened by this disease." Methodist Homes Perry honored for teaching. Ken Perry, Vice President of Operations at the Methodist Home for Children, has received the Montrose Wolf Award, the highest honor given by the International Teaching Family Association, for his contributions to the teaching family model. The Methodist Home uses the model in its foster care, juvenile justice, and in-home programs to provide individualized care that prioritizes therapeutic relationships with caregivers in supportive family-style settings. Perry joined MHC in 1982 as an alternate teaching parent and moved to multiple other roles before joining the leadership team of the Raleigh organization. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, ULI findings should offer Triangle developers clarity. Finally, I was able to read most of the 101-page report issued by the Urban Land Institute last month detailing what the group considers to be the top real estate markets for 2020. The Raleigh-Durham area ranked second behind Austin, Texas, and ahead of Nashville, Tennessee. Surprise, right? But if one looks deeper into the numbers and the ULI forecast, one can create a picture of what our area would look like in the future and the trends that are expected to generate profits for real estate investors betting on the Triangle. First, the numbers. ULI estimates the five-year annual net migration to the Greater Triangle would be about 56,000 every year. That's 153 people added every day. But remember, the ULI market is far broader than the three primary counties in our area. In the RDU market, 33% of the population would be between the ages of 0 and 24, 27% between 25 and 44, 25% between 45 and 64, and 15% are age 65 and over. These numbers clearly suggest if real estate developments are focused to address the needs of people under 24 years and for the 65-plus sector, risks are mitigated proportionally. ULI estimates the five-year annual projected employment change is expected to be about 1.3%, with the majority of jobs created in the science, technology, engineering, and math sector. That's great news because those are the highest paying jobs across most sectors, and the Triangle's ecosystem supports the labor pool. If the U.S. carries a cost of doing business index of 100, the Raleigh-Durham market carries an index of 97, meaning it is still cheaper to do business in this area. Charlotte's index is even lower at 95. In contrast, San Francisco is 137, New York, Manhattan, is 150, and Boston is 117.5. Now, the trends. Hipsterbia is settling in across many markets. Essentially, this is developers creating a community of office buildings, park, entertainment venues, shops and restaurants, and of course, single-family and multifamily housing away from downtown and traffic chaos where people do not leave their communities and have everything they need within walking distance. If affordability at our urban core becomes worse, these communities will attract a lot of younger and older individuals because they eliminate one of the biggest stress factors of growth. Traffic. With more than 50 million individuals now noting they spend more than 50% of their time working at remote locations, look out for communities in the Triangle such as Chatham Park, Briar Chapel, and others to thrive in the coming decade. Everyone is playing on the cool factor. Life expectancy at birth has risen about 25 years in the past century. Not only are people living longer, they would need places to stay for a longer period of time. That also means the life sciences sector will flourish as money is poured into finding miracle drugs and innovative new medical breakthroughs. Again, for real estate investors, go where people are heading. Numbers tell the story. Some other conclusions in the ULI report needs additional vetting, but the overall point and conclusion that the next wave of real estate developments will focus on specific population sectors makes sense. The question is, can the broader economy could support the investments without support to overhaul the nation's infrastructure, roads, bridges, mass transit, utilities, and technology for all? And now we turn to the On Real Estate pages written by Caleb Harshberger. 70-acre mixed-use project planned for Rollsville. A 70-acre community may soon be headed to the burgeoning town of Rollsville, but only if a road realignment project moves forward. Crossland Southeast, a Charlotte-based real estate developer, has announced its plans for Walbrook, a proposed 70-acre mixed-use destination complete with retail, restaurant, and medical office space, as well as a 21-acre residential component by the future intersection of U.S. Highway 401 and Burlington Mill Road. While no site plans have been finalized, Crossland Southeast partner Austin Williams expects between 100,000 and 150,000 square feet of retail space and up to 120 new homes. Crossland Southeast has the land needed for Walbrook under contract, including a 12-acre parcel north of U.S. 401, Main Street in Rollsville, and a 57-plus acre parcel to the south. Indoor skydiving and Garner go-karts headed to Morrisville. Two new entertainment venues are in the works for Morrisville, with plans calling for indoor skydiving across from a local company's second high-speed go-kart track. Garner-based Rush Hour Karting and Texas-based Urban Air have submitted plans to build facilities on a 13-acre property off Airport Boulevard north of the intersection with Chapel Hill Road. Rush Hour Karting co-founder Adam Saeed says the new location will be the company's second site and will feature the latest electric go-karts and a multi-level racetrack design. We've been here at our first location for 15 years now. Our main thing is we're different than standard go-karting, Saeed says. These are real racing machines, over 40 miles per hour. The company targets adult customers, including racing enthusiasts and corporate clients that are looking for a fun and engaging outing for their staff. And we'll stop there with the article as the rest goes into more detail, such as the Morrisville location will also include a 300-person banquet hall, as well as axe throwing, escape rooms, and virtual reality arenas, along with the go-karts. And Urban Air will also feature a family entertainment center with locations around the country that it features trampoline parks and climbing walls. German grocer Lidl moving into the Apex market. The trend of grocers expanding their reach across the triangle continues. German grocer, and actually I believe it's pronounced Lidl, is expanding its footprint in the region with a store planned for Apex. The town approved plans for a new store earlier this year with designs calling for a 29,000-square-foot building situated by the villages of Apex. The site is on 6 acres east of downtown. An opening date for the new store is unclear, and Lidl did not return requests for comment. Lidl, like its German counterpart Aldi, has thousands of locations in Europe. It arrived in the U.S. in 2017 and now has dozens of stores up and down the East Coast. The Apex store will be the latest in a growing roster of Lidl locations headed to the Triangle. This month, the company opened a location at 1105 North Harrison Avenue in Cary, Lidl's third location in the Triangle and its first in Cary. Lidl bought the then-vacant property at 3.46 acres for $3.15 million in 2017 and began developing it earlier this year. The company also plans to open a store in North Raleigh at the intersection of New Hope and Buffalo Roads. That location is expected to open in the spring. The Raleigh store is planned for 36,000 square feet with 180 parking spots, while the Cary location is 29,500 square feet and has 120 parking spots. The Apex store will be the smallest of the three at just over 29,000 square feet. Lidl operates more than 10,500 stores in 29 countries. The chain, founded in 1973, now has more than 65 stores across Delaware, Georgia, New Jersey, North Carolina, Maryland, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, and Virginia. And finally, report shows third quarter bump in sales showings across the Triangle. Housing sales in the Triangle saw a bump last quarter with showings, listings, and sales all on the rise compared to the same time last year, according to the latest report by Stacy Anfinson. And FinCEN credits some of the market's growth with dropping mortgage rates, bringing down monthly home payments even as home prices have increased. According to his report, this has meant a 7% drop in virtual monthly mortgage payments, even as the overall average house price has gone up 5%. And by the numbers, 4%, the increase in showings in the Triangle from third quarter 2018 to third quarter 2019, 8%, the increase in houses listed in the Triangle from third quarter 2018 to third quarter 2019, and 9%, the increase of both resales listed in the Triangle as well as the percentage of pending sales in the Triangle from third quarter 2018 to third quarter 2019. And on the On Healthcare and Education page, written by Seth Thomas Gulledge, college rejected for federal funding. A Triangle Theology School's request for vital federal funding has been rejected. Apex School of Theology, a private religious college in Durham, has been on the verge of collapse due to an ongoing dispute with the U.S. government regarding reimbursement of its federal student aid program funding. But the U.S. Department of Education has now issued a formal denial of its reimbursement application. The rejection, according to Atlanta attorney Edgar Bueno, who is representing the school in the lawsuit against DOE, came just 5 minutes before a court hearing scheduled in Winston-Salem on November 12th. "We were blindsided, he says. In court filings, the school has claimed, if Apex does not receive immediate reimbursement from DOE, Apex cannot continue teaching its students and will be forced to close its doors. Transenteric CEO steps down as company struggles. The CEO of a Triangle biotech firm is stepping down as the company continues to look for ways to finance its operations beyond the first quarter of next year. Research Triangle Park-based Transenteric has announced its longtime president and CEO, Todd Pope, is stepping down effective immediately. But according to a company statement, Pope will remain on as a senior advisor to the company. Pope was named CEO in 2008. His base salary in 2018 was $480,800, according to the company's proxy statement. The leadership transition comes during an uncertain period for the company, which has seen limited sales of its Senhance surgical system and is seeking potential options to keep it afloat beyond first quarter 2020. And in a section called She Said It, the majority of our business service line items do overlap, but there's a lot of focus on gene therapy right now, and there are specific technologies that are very useful in gene therapy, like PCR, polymerase chain reaction, for example. And while we're going to be building out our capacity for that service line as well in Durham, they're bringing that to us right away. That's Beth Hines, Vice President of Global Business Development at BioAgilytics, on the acquisition of Cambridge Biomedical, which is headquartered in Massachusetts. NC State campaign exceeds $1.6 billion goal. It's Christmas come early for NC State University. After a major fundraising effort, the school has reached its target in a $1.6 billion capital campaign, and the campaign still has two more years left. In 2016, the university launched its Think and Do the Extraordinary campaign, with university officials calling its billion-plus target ambitious. But Chancellor Randy Woodson recently announced during his fall address that the campaign has reached the $1.61 billion mark, a transformational achievement, he says. The success of this campaign isn't about dollars raised. All right, so it actually is, he joked in his address. But it's really about what those dollars mean for the students who represent North Carolina's future. It's about how they will benefit. Woodson said the campaign has brought in contributions from more than 88,000 donors, including residents of all 100 counties in the state. The campaign is slated to end December 31, 2021, leaving more than 2 years left in the effort. With its initial goal surpassed, Woodson says the university plans to continue raising funds with a specific interest in adding more need-based scholarships and financial support. He says the increased funding can only serve to add to the university's tremendous upward trajectory. We have 2 years left in this campaign. We're going to keep working hard to raise private support to help NC State achieve its extraordinary potential, Woodson said. Even after the campaign, annual giving to the university is expected to see a significant increase, a typical byproduct of capital campaigns. In fact, Duke University reported more than $507 million in gifts last year and touted its former campaign as a major contributor to its increased sum. UNC Chapel Hill's campaign has already resulted in the largest single donation in the state's history, a $100 million gift from PPD founder Fred Eshelman for its School of Pharmacy. Currently, the campaign has raised $2.97 billion and is set to continue until the end of 2022. And on the On Business page, written by David Pertell, Raleigh, a comfortable city for home affordability. When it comes to home affordability, a new report shows Raleigh shapes up well among other large cities across the nation. The city of Oaks falls in the top third of the nation's 100 most populous cities in a report from RealtyHop. Raleigh ranks as the 32nd city where home ownership is most affordable. The monthly report uses data on household incomes, home listings, mortgage expenses, and property taxes to determine a homeowner's share of income that goes toward housing. Raleigh's statistics included a median income of $61,500 and a median home listing of $299,000, with a mortgage and taxes coming to $1,452 per month. That comes to 28.33% of a homeowner's monthly income spent on housing. For comparison, Charlotte ranks in the bottom quarter for home affordability, with over 40% of income going toward home ownership. Greensboro is in the middle of the pack at 32%. The least affordable cities on the list come with little surprise: Los Angeles and New York, followed by Miami, San Francisco, and Boston. The most affordable city is Detroit, where the median home price is just $50,000. And the big number, 28.33%, the percentage of homeowners' monthly income that goes toward housing in the Raleigh market. And we'll stop right there, as we've actually run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.